From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The representatives of the government of the State of Israel and the Palestinian Liberation Organization, represented respectively by Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and President Mahmoud Abbas in his capacity as chairman of the PLO Executive Committee.
Will the Israel-Palestine summit at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis lead to a Palestinian state? We'll speak with independent Palestinian lawmaker Marwan Barghouti and former Israeli peace negotiator Daniel Levy, then author Naomi Wolf on the end of America.
Yeah. Perfect.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli and Palestinian leaders opened a U.S.-brokered summit Tuesday with a vague pledge to reach a peace deal by the end of next year. The joint statement does not set a binding timeline. It also avoids a firm stance on the core final status issues of Israeli settlements, borders, Jerusalem, and Palestinian refugees. President Bush read the agreement in a morning ceremony.
In furtherance of the goal of two states, Israel and Palestine, living side by side in peace and security, we agree to immediately launch good faith bilateral negotiations in order to conclude a peace treaty, resolving all outstanding issues, including all core issues, without exception, as specified in previous agreements. We agree to engage in vigorous, ongoing, and continuous negotiations and shall make every effort to conclude an agreement before the end of 2008.
The summit continues today with a White House meeting between Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Olmert has already announced he won't discuss core issues until after the summit. But Palestinian negotiator Saab Erekat welcomed the first formal talks in nearly 7 years.
This isn't going to be an easy road. It's going to be a long, difficult road. Issues of Jerusalem, borders, settlements, refugees, security is what make Palestinians and Israelis breathe.
The ousted Hamas-led government has been excluded from the meetings. As the talks began, more than 100,000 people rallied in Gaza in a show of opposition. In a televised speech, dismissed Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh said Hamas would not accept a deal abandoning Palestinian rights.
Any secessions to be made by the Palestinian negotiating team that harms the constant rights of our people will not be binding to our people, and the coming generations will bear no responsibility or obligation towards these secessions.
We'll have more on the summit after headlines. In Pakistan, President Pervez Musharraf has officially stepped down as head of the military. Musharraf passed over control at a ceremony earlier today. The move comes weeks into his crackdown on domestic opposition. Musharraf has dismissed several judges, imposed curbs on the media, and jailed thousands of opponents. He's set to be sworn in to a new 5-year presidential term on Thursday. In Afghanistan, at least 14 construction workers have been killed in a U.S.-led airstrike. The victims had been building a road for the U.S. military in Nuristan province. They were asleep in their tents when NATO warplanes opened fire. NATO officials blame faulty intelligence for the attack. The private military contractor Blackwater Worldwide has been hit with a new lawsuit over the September killings of 17 Iraqis in Baghdad. Filed this week in U.S. District Court, the suit accuses Blackwater guards of ignoring orders and company officials of failing to administer drug tests. According to the Center for Constitutional Rights, new evidence shows Blackwater guards had already dropped off the U.S. official they were guarding when they opened fire. The suit says the guards defied orders to remain with the official and instead headed to Nisour Square, where the shooting later took place. The plaintiffs also accuse Blackwater of routinely sending guards on missions, despite knowing at least one quarter have used steroids or other judgment-altering substances. The United Nations is warning of irreversible environmental catastrophe unless drastic changes are made. In a new report, the UN Human Development Agency says carbon emissions need to be cut by at least half over the next several decades. Climate disasters affected more than 260 million people between 2000 and 2004. 98% of them were in the developing world. Lead report author Kevin Watkins said the onus is on the world's richest nations.
If we fail to tackle the crisis while we still have an opportunity,
That would be a double injustice.
A major UN climate summit convenes next month in Bali, Indonesia. Back in the United States, former House Speaker Dennis Hastert of Illinois has officially stepped down. Hastert's resignation came the same day as another veteran Republican, Mississippi Senator Trent Lott, announced his departure by the end of the year. And the Supreme Court has rejected a challenge to warrantless searches of the homes of welfare recipients. The American Civil Liberties Union had accused San Diego County of violating privacy rights, but the Supreme Court upheld a lower court ruling approving the searches. The court had okayed the searches on grounds county officials are not seeking evidence of crimes, but determining welfare eligibility. The ACLU says the policy violates Fourth Amendment rights, banning unreasonable searches and seizures. A group of dissenting judges have called the searches an attack on the poor. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Annapolis, Maryland, on Tuesday, Israel and the Palestinian Authority announced they've agreed to immediately launch peace negotiations with the goal of reaching a full treaty by the end of 2008. President Bush opened the Annapolis conference by reading aloud a joint statement agreed upon by the two sides just minutes before.
The representatives of the government of the State of Israel and the Palestinian Liberation Organization, represented respectively by Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and President Mahmoud Abbas in his capacity as chairman of the PLO Executive Committee.
Went on to say Israel and the Palestinians would try to reach an agreement on a treaty and Palestinian statehood by the end of next year when Bush is due to leave office. The first negotiations would start on December 12th, with meetings to be held every 2 weeks after that. The announcement was made before high-level diplomats from nearly 50 countries and international bodies. They included top envoys from more than a dozen Arab states, including Syria and Saudi Arabia. In his speech, President Bush said reaching a full peace deal by the end of 2008 is possible. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said the talks must include the status of Jerusalem as a Palestinian capital and the future of refugees.
To achieve that, peace does not depend on the Arab and Islamic position itself, but requires meeting this position with a reciprocal strategic willingness that would basically lead to ending the occupation in all Palestinian occupied territories of 1967, including East Jerusalem, as well as the Syrian Golan, and what remains of occupied Lebanese territories, as well as all other issues relating to the conflict, especially the Palestinian refugee question.
Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert told conference attendees the negotiations inaugurated at Annapolis would address issues that previous talks had avoided.
We will not shy away from any topic. We will deal with all the core issues. I have no doubt that the reality that emerged in our region will change significantly. This will be an extremely difficult process for all of us, but it nevertheless is inevitable.
While the Bush administration has sought to portray the Annapolis conference as a milestone, skepticism of the outcome is high. Major differences remain between the Israelis and Palestinians over core issues like the status of Jerusalem, the border of a Palestinian state, the future of Jewish settlements in the West Bank, and the fate of Palestinian refugees. Meanwhile, Hamas, which controls the Gaza Strip, was not invited to the conference. The group denounced the talks as tens of thousands of supporters rallied in Gaza City in protest. In the West Bank, Palestinian security forces broke up several protests against the Annapolis gathering. One man was killed in Hebron, at least 35 people wounded. And in Jerusalem, Israelis gathered at the Western Wall to protest against the conference. For more on the Annapolis conference, we're joined by two guests. Mustafa Barghouti is an independent Palestinian lawmaker and democracy activist. He's the former information minister of the Palestinian Authority. In 2005, he ran for president, finishing second to Mahmoud Abbas. Daniel Levy is a former Israeli peace negotiator. He served as advisor to the governments of Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. He's currently a senior fellow of the Middle East Policy Initiative at the New America Foundation. They join us both from Washington, D.C. Daniel Levy, what did you expect to come of the conference? Did it meet your expectations?
Well, the expectations were low, Amy, and thank you for having us on, and it's an honor to be with you. And when the expectations are low, the expectations can be met. So I think we knew in advance that this conference wasn't going to be about substance.
Him.
What we weren't sure is whether they'd get
speaking?
The optics right. Here, I think Secretary Rice has something of a feather in her cap. She got all the attendees there. She got a joint statement. We had uplifting speeches, and we got a presidential commitment. That means at least that they've got more invested in this than they have for the last 7 years. So at least when there's an investment, you've got a bit more to lose.
Now
having said that, everything now is about what happens next on the ground. Are there serious negotiations, or do the negotiations get stalled? And the daily situation that you had a little report about there, does that daily situation improve for the people, or is it just as dreadful? And if it's the negative side of that ledger, and unfortunately that's probably where the bookmakers would be, then no one comes out of yesterday smelling of roses, and we're all back where we started. So I think it's good that the Americans are engaged again, but the kind of engagement matters, and I'm not sure we're going to see a change. I was very worried by the old, divisive global war on terror, dividing the world into good and bad narrative that the president used yesterday.
Mm. Mustafa Barghouti, your response to the summit at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis?
Well, the only official thing that came out of this is the statement, the joint statement. And in that statement, the Palestinian delegation failed to present any of the Palestinian demands. Basically, the Palestinian delegation being very weak and with great doubts about how representative it is, made one concession after the other. And everything they promised the Palestinian people, they failed to achieve. They didn't mention the issue of Jerusalem, the issue of borders, the freeze of settlements, which we've been asking for. And basically, the whole document and the whole outcome of the meeting has practically met every Israeli need or demand. What Livni promised has happened, which is that security comes before negotiations and it becomes a condition of negotiations. What is most drastic is that after all this big gathering and all these expenses on such a conference or a meeting, all we get is the same roadmap that was there back in 2003 and that was never implemented. And in my opinion, what happened was very risky, because instead of discussing the real issues, the Israeli side managed to mobilize the American side to marginalize completely the quartet, which has no role from now on, to completely ignore and omit any mentioning of the basis and reference of negotiations like UN resolutions.
The quartet
United
being
Nation
Mustafa Barghouti, the
everything that used to be mentioned, like international law, international humanitarian law, everything was dismissed. What the only reference that remains is what Israelis accept and what they don't accept. And the whole issue becomes an issue of how the Palestinian Authority would be transformed to become a security sub-agent for occupation. And that is a condition. If the Palestinian Authority does not fulfill that, which is objectively impossible, then there will be no progress on any field. In my opinion, that is very dangerous, and it is really quite dangerous that the Israelis managed to get everything they want without any balance.
The fact, Mustafa Barghouti, that Saudi Arabia appeared in this kind of summit with Israel for the first time, a public meeting?
This is not the first time, by the way. This is, again, exaggerated. Saudi Arabia attended the first international conference in Madrid conference,
In 1991.
In 1991, and they were present there. And Saudi Arabia was instrumental in presenting the Arab Initiative, which drew a very detailed plan of how peace could be achieved, mainly specifying that Israel must end occupation of Palestinian territories and Arab territories, and in exchange, Israel would get complete and full recognition and total peace with all Arab countries. Unfortunately, even the Arab Initiative was not mentioned, and the Saudis said they came with great hesitation. I'm sure they came because they didn't want to upset the United States, but I think all the Arab countries would probably walk out of this conference feeling very bad, about how they were treated, about ignoring the Arab Initiative. And I know that the Israelis consider this as a big achievement because they think this gives them a green line now for normalization with Arab countries without solving the Palestinian issue. But in my opinion, you know, Palestinians have made a big compromise. The Arabs have supported that compromise, which is two-state solution. The Palestinians have accepted to have a state in less than half of what was assigned to them back in the United Nations resolutions in 47. And now what are they getting? The roadmap. You know, there comes a point where you cannot further compromise the compromise. And what happened in Annapolis was basically, in my opinion, a big blow to the possibility of peace based on two-state solution. And this might be the last opportunity.
Danielle Levy, your response.
I'm afraid I only caught the very end of Mustafa's comments.
Well, one of the key issues that he's talked about is that basically Israel got its way at this conference. And he also felt that the Palestinian negotiating team was very weak.
First, I think the Palestinian negotiating team were starting from a weak hand. First of all, there's the structural reality of the conflict, which Mustafa, of course, is more aware of than myself, which is the imbalance between occupier and occupied. When the outside power that convenes the conference is also historically closer to the occupier, then of course you really have an entire process that's out of sync. I think Mustafa, in that respect, referred to the quartet. You see, the quartet was an opportunity to redress that balance in a way, and to have the international community alongside the Americans, giving this not only more international legitimacy, but a different framing. And I think yesterday, reading between the lines was almost the death of the quartet, because all the follow-up and all the monitoring will be exclusively American-led.
And just to clarify, the quartet being European Union, the United Nations, Russia, and the United States.
Absolutely. I can maybe set Mustafa a little bit at ease in terms of where the Israeli papers have come out this morning. The Israeli papers are not celebrating this as a great victory for Prime Minister Olmert, and they're focusing more on this was not normalization. And I think in that respect, Mustafa's right. There was an element of prematurity about bringing all the world together for something that was the beginning of new negotiations. The possible positive is that there's a momentum out of these talks. But the negative, as Mustafa says, and I agree with him, is that you can't do a conference like this every week, okay? So if you bring together this kind of a conference and something serious does not come out of it, then we're in an even worse place, not only because hopes have been raised and expectations dashed, but because so here, I mean, you, the people listening to this think, oh, you know, these guys have been killing each other for thousands of years, they'll carry on, and why should we bother being involved? And everyone loses faith and loses belief. And that's a net negative. I would argue that means we have to do everything, despite all the odds being, you know, not great. We have to do everything to try and turn this into a process that works. I agree that that's very difficult, and that the leadership role played by the United States would have to be radically different to what it has been in the last 7 years.
One of the other issues Mustafa Barghouti raised was the sidelining of the Arab League deal. Why is it taking so long for that to be acted on for a Palestinian state, Daniel?
Absolutely. I think, let me speak as an Israeli and a former Israeli official here. I think we've gotten to yes. The Arab Initiative is Israel getting the recognition it yearned for ever since its establishment and its creation. Mustafa's right. In 1991, at the Madrid conference, everyone was there. People forget that in 1996, there was a summit in Sharm el-Sheikh where the Arab states attended together with Israel and President Clinton. So we've been building and building, and in 2002, there it is, a formal Arab League initiative offering full normal relations for a comprehensive land for peace. That should have been the yes moment for Israel. Somehow we've plodded through the last 5 years, partly because Ariel Sharon was prime minister, and I don't think he had any intentions to make peace, partly because President Bush was the president of the United States, and he made no effort whatsoever to turn this Arab initiative into a workable peace process. The challenge for Israel, and by the way, I think for all his detractors, and for all the reality on the ground, which I think Olmert has not done anything significant to improve, I do think the Israeli prime minister spoke in very empathetic and sincere terms yesterday, and I give him some credit for that. But the real challenge is, can Israel embrace this offer and say yes to the 67 lines, say yes to, in fact, 78% of mandatory Palestine?
What is Israel's interest in rejecting the deal?
You know, Amy, I wish I could tell you and give you a good answer. My best answer at that is there are groups inside Israel who are not inconsequential, who are greater land of Israel territorialists, who believe that this is God-given land. You have your own religious fundamentalists here in this country. That's one section, and they're quite effective politically, and prime ministers tend to be worried when they go against them. You also have security hawks, who will always find the security reason why, even if we can make a compromise one day, we can't do it tomorrow, and we need to be here for our security. In 2007, to tell me I need a hill on the West Bank for my security, I think is ridiculous. But there's a third reason, which is that Israel, rather than turning to its friend America and that friend saying, hey, guys, this is in your interest, it's in our interest, let's do this, America is normally saying, if you want to carry on your crazy, self-destructive policy of occupation, don't expect us to change it for you. In fact, we'll continue to back you. It's like a drunkard turning to his friend and the friend giving him another bottle of vodka and then giving him the car keys.
We're going to go to break and come back to this discussion. We'll get Mustafa Barghouti's response. We're speaking with Daniel Levy, who's a former Israel peace negotiator and has served as advisor to the governments of Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. We've also been speaking with Mustafa Barghouti, independent Palestinian lawmaker and democracy activist. We'll be back with both of them in a minute. Azouz, Palestinian Love Story, the song. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman. We're talking about the U.S. Naval Academy at Annapolis summit that took place yesterday. It's continuing today in Washington, D.C., where our guests are. Our guests are Mustafa Barghouti, a medical doctor, a head of the Palestinian National Initiative, independent Palestinian lawmaker, presidential candidate, and democracy activist. He was the former information minister of the Palestinian Authority. Daniel Levy is with the New America Foundation, a former Israeli peace negotiator under both Yitzhak Rabin and Ehud Barak. Mustafa Barghouti, respond to what Daniel Levy has said and also what's happening on the ground right now in West Bank and Gaza and the fact that Hamas was not included, what that means.
Well, first of all, let me say that I almost agree with most of what Daniel said. I think we're both in agreement because we both see that there is not only a loss of opportunity here, but even a killing of an opportunity. Originally, Israel occupied the Palestinian and Arab territories in 67, and since then it's been claiming that it wants peace and that the territory can be exchanged with peace. The Palestinians made their deal, they made their compromise by accepting a small, little, tiny states in West Bank and Gaza as a solution. And the Arabs have made the compromise and said if Israel ends occupation, they will have peace with Israel. What we see today is an Israeli retraction from that. What we saw in Annapolis is a situation where the Israelis are saying occupation will continue, basically, and the Americans are saying that's okay. And instead of talking about final settlements that would end all the elements of the conflict, they are talking again about the roadmap, which was invented in 2003, and that has failed. What does it mean? It means that the roadmap includes two basic points in the first stage. The first one is that Israel should freeze all settlement activities. But now the Israelis are saying freeze of settlement activities does not mean stopping the growth of settlements that already exist, and there are 133 settlements already in the West Bank and Gaza Strip that were built illegally. These are colonies that are illegal by international law. They say we want to continue their growth, but we will not build new settlements. Well, they don't need new settlements because already 133 is enough to destroy the option and potential for a Palestinian state. On the Palestinian side, the first stage obliges them to provide certain security measures, which would simply mean that the Palestinian Authority should become a security sub-agent for Israeli occupation. This is the first time in history of human beings that the people who are under occupation, who are under oppression, who live in an apartheid system, have to provide protection to their occupier, who happens to be Israel, which has the fourth, probably largest military force in the world, being the strongest military force in the region, having a larger nuclear arsenal than France, a bigger air force than Britain, and definitely it is the fourth or fifth largest military exporter in the world. The Palestinians cannot fulfill that demand, and that's why they're doomed to fail. Because if they become a security sub-agent for Israel, first of all, this is difficult to achieve because they don't have sovereignty, they don't control the roads. The Palestinian Authority cannot even move 100 policemen from one city to another because we are under occupation. On the other hand, if they go far in oppressing their own people, they will lose completely their legitimacy. So in my opinion, the roadmap is about putting Palestinians in front of an impossible mission and then use that as an excuse for Israel to impose its unilateral solution, which is nothing but an apartheid system. And talking about that and the reality on the ground, let me just give you a few figures. Israel maintained 562 military checkpoints. They didn't remove a single one of them. There are also 610 flying checkpoints that make the people's life miserable. It doesn't allow freedom of movement. It prevents freedom of economy. It prevents people's accessibility to health and education. More than that, Israel is continuing to build the apartheid wall, which will be three times the length of Berlin Wall and would destroy contiguity of the Palestinian territories. And in addition to that, in daily life, what you see is a very profound system of discrimination. On average, a Palestinian is allowed to use no more than 50 cubic meters of water per year, while an Israeli illegal colonialist can use up to 2,400. We have to pay double the price for water and electricity, and we pay for our own water, which Israel controls. Out of 936 million cubic meters of water in the West Bank, Israel takes away 800 million. If you take GDP, for instance, the Israeli GDP now is 30 times more than the Palestinian gross domestic product. At the same time, we are obliged to buy products at Israeli market price, and we are obliged by the agreements that were concluded before to give Israel our taxes, and then Israel would decide whether we can use our own money for our health needs or educational facilities or to pay the salaries of teachers and doctors. This is nothing but a system of discrimination that can only be called an apartheid system.
I want to ask Daniel Levy about your description, which is not yours alone, of comparing the situation in Gaza and West Bank as an apartheid system. Yesterday, Daniel Levy, we played a speech of the former South African Archbishop, Desmond Tutu, that he gave in Boston. He was disinvited from the University of St. Thomas and St. Paul for making comparisons to apartheid, but he's been reinvited to that university to speak. Would you call it an apartheid system?
Well, I guess some people might expect at this stage that as a patriotic Israeli, I reject the comparison and I explain that against all our best intentions, Israel has been forced into this occupation. There's nothing we'd like more than to end it. I'm not going to do that because I'm not going to defend the settlements and the occupation because I'm a patriotic Israeli. And to me, the fight over the descriptive word of whether this is apartheid or not, and plenty of Israelis would use that terminology also, is less important than saying, we've got to end this occupation, we've got to end the settlements, and as a patriotic Israeli, I'm not going to defend something that is so against Israel's national interest, just as I imagine many people would say, I'm a patriotic American, and that's why I think this war in Iraq or bombing Iran would be an absolute disaster for America, and that makes me more of a patriot than the people who are going to tell me, no, you have to stand behind the military, etc. Mustafa, with or without the term, and all I'm saying is I think the debate it can sometimes distract us, because I think the important thing especially is the equation that Mustafa drew out, and it's one that people have for some reason real difficulty getting their heads around, and we saw a repeat, as he said, of the same equation yesterday, which is that somehow under conditions of occupation Palestinians will provide Israelis with full security. Now, many Israelis are mature enough and have experienced this for long enough that we understand that that's a nonsense, that occupation and security don't go together. Sure, we would like to see more security even as we pursue a peace process. And absolutely, a post-occupation Israel should be absolutely secure and live in peace, and there should be no question of violence being
used by
the
neighbors. Daniel Levy, you've been living in Washington, D.C. Can you talk about the climate here? As you said, this was a U.S. initiative, this summit in Annapolis. What are the forces, the pressures on the Bush administration? Who are they responding to? Do you think there is less of a debate in this country than there is in Israel?
Well, there is less of a debate. I mean, everyone constantly heaps praise on the vibrant democracy that is Israel, and rightly so. I mean, that's one of the things I most love about my country. But I wish in the heaping of that praise, people would be as open and as self-critical and as questioning about everything that goes on there as we are back home. Just to take one example, look at the pages of Haaretz today. Haaretz's lead foreign editor turns around and says the most important thing that would happen next would be if you had Palestinian unity talks between Fatah and Hamas. And I know, Mustafa, those are not the only factions, and I respect your Mubadara initiative. But I think sometimes it's too easy to say that there is a monolithic lobby here that stifles debate. I don't think that elected public officials in America or the broader American public should get off that easy, if I may say so. I think every American has the right and the ability to say that they think this matters, that they think that we're doing America no favors, Israel no favors, and certainly the Palestinians no favors by not putting front and center the fact that we need a peace now that's based on an end of occupation. Yes, a Bush administration has a right-wing Republican Jewish constituency that's very right-wing, and you hear the language of the candidates today. You have the Christian fundamentalist Zionist right, who are actually, in many ways, more aggressive than the national Jewish organizations in some of their positions. You have the neoconservatives, who I think have been the most disastrous factor. But on the Democrat side, I'd like to see more people saying, hey, We can't go along with this war on terror narrative. We can't go along with business as usual. The majority of American Jews are with us on this. You have great organizations out there, Israel Policy Forum, Americans for Peace Now, Brit Tzedek V'Shalom, and we should get behind those and other initiatives to try and say this is the alternative to the current policy, not more of the same that some, at least, of the Democrat candidates, unfortunately, give voice to.
Mustafa Barghouti, we're going to end with you. Also want to ask you about the prisoners, more than 400 prisoners the Israeli government released. Your response to that in ahead of these talks?
Well, that's another joke or misleading statement, because Israel is going to release 432 prisoners. Half of them have finished already their half of their term. One-third have already finished two-thirds of their terms. But the most important thing is that during the same period of time, Israel has arrested 1,650 new prisoners. Since January up till now, Israel released 900 prisoners, with including the 432 they were released this week. But during the same period of time, Israel has arrested 3,750 new Palestinian prisoners. So the total number of prisoners is increasing, and we are having now 11,500 prisoners in Israeli jails. Most of them are political prisoners, including 90 women, including 350 children that are kept in jail, including many leaders, including 46 members of our Palestinian parliament. And nobody is protesting against that. I mean, it's really interesting when people speak about democracy, but at the same time, not a single word is said about Israel arresting one-third of the members of the Palestinian parliament. On the other hand, I want to make one clarification here. When I struggle for the freedom of the Palestinian people and struggle for ending this apartheid system and this occupation, I do not see myself and my colleagues as people who struggle only for Palestinians. I feel I struggle also for Israelis, because an Israel that is creating an apartheid system in the 21st century is not going to be secure. And an Israeli state that creates apartheid and continues occupation leaves its citizens with very bad feeling, because they cannot feel proud about being the only apartheid in this world at this time. And that's why I think the struggle we do is not only for Palestinians. It's for our freedom, but it's also for their freedom. Because the only when occupation ends, and only when this injustice and discrimination stops, then Israelis themselves will feel really free.
We're going to leave it there. I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Mustafa Barghouti ran for president. He is an independent Palestinian lawmaker, a medical doctor, former information minister of the Palestinian Authority, ran for president, lost to Mahmoud Abbas. We are also have been joined by Daniel Levy, former Israeli peace negotiator, who is now with the New America Foundation, served as an advisor to the governments of Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll be joined by author Naomi Wolf. She has written the book, The End of America. Stay with us.
I'm going to tell all you fascists, you may be surprised. People all over this world are getting bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Race hatred cannot stop us, this one thing I know. The poll tax and Jim Crow and greed have got to go. You're bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Are you fascists about to lose? People of every color marching side by side, marching across the fields where a million fascists died. You're bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. All you fascists are bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose.
Billy Bragg and Wilco, all you fascists, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting in over 500 stations around the country on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM college and community radio stations, as well as on public access TV stations, on PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available there in Spanish for any radio station to take. Over 150 around the world are taking those Spanish headlines. I'm Amy Goodman, and today we're joined by a special guest who's just written a book. The United States is on the road to becoming a fascist society right under our very noses. That's the premise of the new book by feminist social critic Naomi Wolf. It's called The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot, and it's already on the New York Times bestseller list. Naomi Wolf outlines what she sees as the 10 steps to shut down a democratic society. She argues the Bush administration has already implemented many of these steps. Naomi Wolf is the author of several books, including the 90s feminist classic, The Beauty Myth. Critics describe her latest book, The End of America, as a wake-up call to Americans to heed the lessons of history and fight to save their democracy before it's too late. Naomi Wolf joins us in our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Start off with the stories that you tell in your book.
Well, they're the stories of societies that were systematically closed down by would-be despots, would-be dictators, whether they were on the left or the right, who essentially developed a blueprint in the first part of the 20th century to crush democracies or to crush democracy movements. So there are also individual stories of how people react as a democracy is being closed down. But I guess the book really began with a very personal story, because I was forced to write it, even though I didn't really want to, by a dear friend who is a Holocaust survivor's daughter. And when we spoke about news events, she kept saying, "They did this in Germany. They did this in Germany." And I really didn't think that made sense. I thought that was very extreme language. But finally, she forced me to sit down and start reading the histories, of course, not of the later years, because she wasn't talking about German outcomes, 38, 39. She was talking about the early years, 1930, 31, 32, when Germany was a parliamentary democracy. And there was this systematic assault using the rule of law to subvert the rule of law. And once I saw how many parallels there were, not just in strategy and tactics but that we're seeing again today, but actually in images and sound bites and language, then I read other histories of Italy in the 20s, Russia in the 30s, East Germany in the 50s, Czechoslovakia in the 60s, Pinochet's coup in Chile in 73, the crushing of the democracy movement in China at the end of the 80s. And I saw that there is a blueprint that would-be dictators always do the same 10 things, whether they're on the left or the right, and that we are seeing these 10 steps taking place systematically right now in the United States.
Lay them out.
Well, they're not happy. The first step is that all would-be dictators or would-be despots, which is what the founders of our country, who foresaw exactly this kind of possibility, would call them, all would-be dictators invoke a terrifying internal and external threat. And often it's a real threat, which they will hyper-manipulate. For instance, Stalin spoke about sleeper cells, which is one of those phrases that are being sort of recirculated now by the Bush White House. And this was an invention. He said there were capitalist secret agents who were hiding among good Soviet citizens and who are going to rise up at a signal and create terrorist mayhem. Fake story, but it worked to frighten citizens. Pinochet talked about a real threat, armed insurgents. There were armed insurgents, but he hyped it using fake documents. And we saw, we see this a lot in the historical blueprint, that a would-be dictator will fake documents. His were called Plan Z. He claimed they were going to bomb infrastructure, assassinate leaders. We saw fake documents used by the White House to hype a terror threat when they used the fake yellow cake documents to claim that Iraq was trying to secure yellow cake uranium. And remember the famous soundbite, we can't wait for the smoking gun to come in the form of a mushroom cloud to drive us into an illegal war with a nation we were not at war with.
You also talk about the language, like the Department of Homeland Security.
That is where I, as a social critic and a student of language, get really scared. It's scary enough to see these 10 steps, but what is terrifying to me personally is how many actual phrases are being recycled and tactics. Homeland Security, Heimat, became popularized by the National Socialists. Goebbels developed the practice of embedding journalists. Leni von Riefenstahl was embedded, for instance, in Poland, and we're seeing
the embedding famous German filmmaker.
If you look at the sequence of Hitler descending in an airplane and von Riefenstahl's famous triumph of the will and being greeted by the uniformly armed paramilitary sort of surrounding their leader, and him saying, help us accomplish our mission. And then you look at other famous images from this administration.
Like George Bush on
mission accomplished. Exactly right. You look at how, Hitler said, we have to invade Czechoslovakia because they're a staging ground for terrorists and they're abusing their ethnic minorities, again, a country they were not at war with. When the WMD charge vanished, the White House said, we have to invade Iraq because they're a staging ground for terrorists and they're abusing their ethnic minorities, on and on and on. I mean, this one scares me to death. You know, the Mussolini developed, a parliamentary democracy. Italy was in the teens and into 1920. He developed the black shirts, which were these paramilitary thugs that beat up newspaper editors, terrorized the population, and they intimidated people counting the vote in Milan. And then Hitler studied Mussolini. So many things were repeated by Hitler. Stalin studied Hitler. Hitler studied Stalin. But Hitler developed the brown shirts, the SA, who intimidated people counting the vote in Austria. So 90% of them voted for their own annexation because there were the brown shirts. And you saw this scene of identically dressed Republican staffers in Florida in 2000 intimidating people counting the vote. So things like that are really chilling. They're more and more chilling as I think right now people are kind of ramping up their awareness of these echoes. And what you also see predictively, because the blueprint is predictive, is that the White House is ramping up its implementation of some of the scariest aspects of this crackdown.
You began with these stories back in the summer of 2006 of headlines from a two-week period. Give some of those examples.
Well, 2006 seems so long ago and so innocent a time, considering how swiftly we've zoomed along implementing this blueprint, or we're suffering this implementation. In 2006, a blogger was jailed in San Francisco. In 2006, people in Alabama couldn't get a fair hearing for protecting voter rolls. There was the beginning of the Military Commissions Act of 2006, in which the state basically legalized torture, which is one of these crucial turning points as an open society closes down.
You talk about Christine Axsmith, the computer security expert working for the CIA, who posted a message on a blog site on a top secret computer network criticizing waterboarding, saying waterboarding is torture and torture is wrong.
And then she lost her security clearance. She's one of many, many whistleblowers, key individuals who have tried to take a stand against some of these positions and who have faced, again, in a closing society, this is what happens. This is step seven, target key individuals. They face job loss, character assassination, or worse. Valerie Plame's bolts were taken away from her back deck, 50 feet off the ground. She has two toddlers. People are being put on the watch list for criticizing the government, for engaging in anti-war protest. Their kids are being put on the watch list. But yeah, back then, all she said was, it's wrong. And now we've just confirmed an attorney general who pretends not to know what waterboarding is, because if he acknowledged that it's against U.S. and international law, he'd be confirming the fact that there are criminals in the White House right now who have already staged a coup.
You say step three is establishing secret prisons.
That's right. You establish secret prisons, and what I mean by that is unaccountable prisons where torture takes place. And often there will be a military tribunal system set in place. Lenin pioneered that. Mussolini developed the Confino system. Hitler again studied Mussolini and developed the People's Court. And what starts to happen is, and this is what's so scary about Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and these black sites around the world, apart from the moral issue, and your interview just now with the Palestinian representative brought me to tears, because when he said it's not just the Palestinians he's concerned about, it's the Israelis who lose their souls by this kind of occupation. It's not just the often innocent prisoners in Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and these black sites around the world we should be concerned about. It's our own American souls that are at stake. But just for purely personal reasons, we should be afraid when the state starts to torture people that it sees as at the margins, or that citizens see at the margins, brown people on an island in Guantanamo with Muslim names, whatever. That's what they did in Germany in 31, 32. Anarchists, communists, gypsies, Jews, whatever, homosexuals, whatever. You know, people didn't care because they were seen as at the margins. People knew about the torture cellars in Germany. But then what always happens, always, you can't name a society in which this doesn't happen, Amy, is that there's a blurring of the line. And once the state legalizes torture of people at the margins, inevitably it will begin to direct state abuse at people at the heart of civil society. And it's always the same cast of characters: journalists, editors, opposition leaders, outspoken clergy, and labor leaders. And when that starts to happen, society can close down in a heartbeat, because people start to censor themselves.
It's interesting. During the lead up to Nazi Germany, American reporters were fired by their American editors, pulled back from Germany, because they were sounding the warning. They were saying, we're seeing a fascist society build. And they were told that they were biased, they were not understanding the circumstances in which Hitler was rising up. People were concerned about their economy. They had been devastated, and that they were being alarmist.
Interesting. That's really interesting. I mean, I'm immediately thinking, as you say that, which I actually hadn't known, that I'm thinking of a lot of books I've been reading lately about deep U.S. involvement. Some corporations were deeply involved in Nazi Germany, making millions, like IBM. How did they round people up so quickly? You know, in Germany, when they were rounding up the Jews so fast, it's because IBM had developed this prototype of a punch card system, and they were secretly working with the Nazis. Prescott Bush, Bush's grandfather, was making millions in consolidation with Krupps, the Thyssen. And it's very interesting to me, because in the Nuremberg trials, they went after these industrialists like Krupps. And so there was a moment at which the Nuremberg trial was about to identify supporters of these war crimes who were U.S. collaborators.
But they didn't.
But they didn't. But I think it's interesting that there is that historical memory in the family.
It's the question of who controlled the trials. Right. It's the question of who controlled the trials and not wanting their own people to be involved. You talk then for developing a paramilitary force and surveilling ordinary citizens.
Yeah, that's another big one. I just want to note about the blurring of the line, why we're in such a moment of danger right now. The president has said that he can say, Amy Goodman, you're an enemy combatant. Naomi Wolf, you're an enemy combatant. This guy behind the camera, you're an enemy combatant. Person walking down the street, enemy combatant. And it doesn't matter that we're innocent U.S. citizens. I mean, we could be Republicans, we could be evangelicals, doesn't matter. He can take us, and if he says it's true, that makes it true, because it's a status offense. And he can put us in a 10 by 12 foot cell in a Navy brig in solitary confinement for 3 years, making it difficult for us to see our families, to contact an attorney, to get charges filed. They can't torture us yet, though I was chilled to learn that an advisor to the White House was reported in a British newspaper yesterday as not ruling out waterboarding against U.S. citizens. However, psychiatrists know that prolonged isolation makes sane people insane. That's what happened to Jose Padilla. So, you know, when I say everyone's got their moment at which they start to silence themselves, the day I read in the New York Times that someone I identify with has been named an enemy combatant and is sitting in a Navy brig in isolation, that's when I'm going to stop talking in a context like this, because that's when I will become too afraid.
We're talking to Naomi Wolf. Her book is The End of America, A Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot, number 6 in these 10 steps toward fascism. infiltrate citizen groups. 7 arbitrarily detain and release citizens. 8 target key individuals. Infiltrate citizens groups, the evidence.
Well, the ACLU is suing many agents of the state for illegally infiltrating citizens groups. It's not a new thing in the United States. COINTELPRO did it quite a lot. But it is a hallmark. It's an extension of surveillance society, and it's a hallmark. It's an extension of step number 4, which was the surveillance apparatus. Now, you can't close down a democracy without a surveillance apparatus aimed at ordinary citizens. And what many of us know is that there's been a heightening of surveillance in the wake of 9/11. But what we've got to understand is that our country is unique right now in directing the crackdown on civil liberties and surveillance at citizens. Countries like England and Spain experienced the same terror attacks, the same kind of terror attacks by the same bad guys that we did, but they're not using that as a pretext to strip citizens of civil liberties in the same way. And what is so terrifying, again, Italy had a surveillance apparatus. People were informing on each other. Germany, surveillance, the Stasi in East Germany. You couldn't have a conversation with your neighbor without fearing that it was going to go into your file. You can't close down a society without a paramilitary force. We skipped over that one. It's very important. Blackwater, the black shirts, the brown shirts, that's not answerable to the people, and surveillance. So why am I petrified? Why, you know, when I read about Blackwater and about surveillance? I was on the watch list for 1.5 years, Amy, which means that every time I got on a plane, I got taken aside for extra searching. Quadruple S, high risk, Naomi, you know. And I was told you're on the list. And I found out that many critics of the administration are on the list. UCLA, ACLU, excuse me, staffers, Ted Kennedy, anti-war activists, David Altoon, a highly decorated Vietnam War veteran who was critical of the Iraq War. Not only is he on the list, but people who come to me in tears after my readings are more upset that now their kids are on the list if they write a letter critical of the Bush administration.
Have you been able to get off the list?
Well, I was off the list till this book came out, and now I'm back on the list. Why is this more than a sort of irritation or, you know, in a strong society, it's just like, whatever, you know, this is kind of a compliment. But in a closing society, it gets very frightening. In February, the management of the lists, which have swollen from 45,000 to 775,000 Americans, they're adding 20,000 names a month, right? Where are they getting those names? Remember when I said, how do they round up people so quickly in a closing society? The management of the lists is going to go from the airlines to the government. And in February, unless we push back this regulation, it's being slipped in very quietly, we are going to have to apply to the state to get an airline ticket to cross a border, which moves us from 1931 to about 1936.
Number 9 and number 10 of your steps toward fascism. Restrict the press, cast criticism as espionage, dissent as treason, subvert the rule of law is 11. What is the Patriot's task, where you conclude?
Well, oh, the Patriot's task is first to wake up. I mean, all around the world, democracy activists who are familiar with these same 10 steps are sort of waving their arms at us, going, no, you know, recognize this. You don't make it easier for the president to declare martial law, as we just did with the 2007 Defense Authorization Act. You don't make it easier for the president to lock up political opponents in a cell or strip people of habeas corpus. No, you don't make it easier for the president to have a paramilitary force like Blackwater, composed of hand-selected torturers and murderers from countries like Chile and Nigeria and El Salvador, where they're trained to torture their own civilians. You know, you don't set them loose in Illinois and Southern California and North Carolina. No, bad idea. So first you wake up, you see the blueprint.
Seconds.
Finally, we have to, we've started the AmericanFreedomCampaign.org. It's a democracy movement to restore the rule of law. We're calling for lawyers across the country and citizens to call for hearings, special prosecutor, identify the crimes, impeach and prosecute, and save the country.
Naomi Wolf, I want to thank you for being with us. Do you think Democratic candidates are raising these issues for president?
Not enough. This is a transpartisan issue, and we all need to push them, hold their feet to the fire.
Naomi Wolf's book is The End of America. Thank you for being with us. Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Shufo Dokadoos, Angelique Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.